Welcome to a very special presentation of the novel A Really Good Day by James Hosek. On its surface, it's a story about a remarkable round of golf. But if you're not a golfer, if you quickly change the channel, if you accidentally come upon a tournament on TV, I encourage you to listen anyway. It's a story about family and friendship. It's a story about redemption and second chances. It's a story about promises made and promises kept. It's a story about once-in-a-lifetime experiences. But most of all, it is one man's love letter to his family. That man was my brother, the author, James Hosek. Aside from being an amazing veterinarian, woodworker, gardener, husband, father, brother, son, and friend, he was a writer. Writers are often told to write what they know. And in this, his first book, he did that in more ways than I can count. It will make you laugh. It will make you cry. And it will make you stand up and cheer. So sit back and enjoy as Jim takes you on a fun, entertaining journey through 18 holes of golf and one man's really good day. Chapter 3. The first hole.
"Attention golfers," announced the voice over the loudspeakers. "Would Scott Hanover, Gerald Spaulding, and Pete Baldwin please report to the starter? You will be teeing off in 5 minutes.
Paul grabbed Scott's bag and stood up. "This is it. Boy, I wish I was teeing off with you. I wish I was carrying your bag. You have a better chance against these guys than me," answered Scott. "Ah, there's always next year for me. I'm going to miss golfing with you after Sarah has the baby," lamented Paul. "Is she going to come out to watch?" "Watch golf? She leaves the room whenever I put a PGA tournament on TV. It's a good way to get some time to myself," he laughed. Scott signed in with the red-jacketed official holding a clipboard and noted he would be teeing off second, after Peter Baldwin, alphabetical by last name. The official was overweight and balding, his head attached to his shoulders without the benefit of a neck, and his collar remained open under his red tie. Paul and Scott walked over to the tee and joined the other two golfers with their caddies. "You must be Scott Hanover," greeted one of the men. He was short, maybe 5'4", and had thick dark hair and thick dark-rimmed glasses. He wore a gray sweatshirt over his golf shirt. His smile made him squint as his lips parted slightly from oversized teeth. "I'm Pete Baldwin," he introduced himself. "This is Jerry Spaulding." Scott's grip shifted over to the other man, and he almost had his hand wrenched off his wrist. Jerry was about Scott's height, but blonde-haired and very athletic. He looked more like a baseball player or even a basketball player, and golf was probably a hobby sport for him. His muscles on his arms bulged the knit cuffs on his short-sleeved golf shirt. The chilly morning seemed to have no effect on him. "This is my friend and caddy, Paul Bauer," Scott introduced. The handshakes were exchanged again, and the official announced quietly to Pete, "You're up." Pete took his driver from his caddy and pulled a ball and tee from his right-side pants pocket, the tee already gripped onto the ball, ready to be pushed into the grass in the tee box. Scott and Jerry took up their positions to Pete's right, and Scott gazed down the first fairway. It was the first of four par-5 holes, and relatively straight and hazard-free until you reached the green, where two sand traps guarded each side. Along the fairway, there was little danger of ending up in the woods on either side for the first 300 yards, but then the trees closed in, coming into play on the second and third shot. Jerry took a couple of practice swings, then stepped up to address the ball. Scott remembered the old Honeymooners episode when Ed Norton was trying to teach Ralph golf, and when addressing the ball, tipped his hat sincerely at it and said, "Hello, ball." He chuckled to himself quietly, trying not to disturb Pete's concentration. Pete had a pretty short backswing, and as soon as he hit the ball, his squinty face dropped into a frown. The ball had sliced, veering to the right of the fairway into the taller cut grass of the rough, and rolled behind an 8-foot pine tree. Scott said nothing as they passed each other, exchanging positions. What could he say? He hoped his shot wasn't as bad as that. At least Pete hadn't lost it in the trees. Scott pushed his tee into the ground and placed his ball on it, measuring the distance to the ground by the thickness of his knuckles. That gave him his perfect tee height when he used his driver. The ground was soft and yielding, probably watered the night before in preparation for today. This course was the nicest of all the Cook County public courses, and it showed in its maintenance. He rotated the ball on the tee so that he was looking square at the yellow rubber duck Paul had printed on the ball. He smiled at it and looked at Paul. "Go duck," Paul said. He stepped up and used his driver to mark an invisible line through the air from the flag on the green to a position 3 feet behind his ball. He would position his feet parallel to that line to set up his aim. It didn't always ensure a straight shot, but he had learned long ago not to trust his ability to walk right up to the ball and place his stance. More often than not, his toes formed a line that led far left of where he wanted to aim. His ritual drew a confused look from Jerry and Pete, but he was determined not to let them intimidate him. They were better golfers, so he wanted to make sure he had taken every step to guarantee he had a good game. Scott stepped up to his imaginary line and looked down at the ball. He set his left foot just to the left of the ball, his right foot a shoulder's width away. As he tilted his head back to stretch his neck, he noticed a girl with a red ponytail about 15 yards away on the cart path leading down the fairway. She had a large camera hoisted on her shoulder and appeared to be taping him. Perhaps she just wanted to make sure she had a good angle for when the top-ranked players made their start in an hour and a half or two. Scott took a deep breath, and his love for this often frustrating game was invigorated by the fall scents. For some reason, he was taken back to his first golf swing on a course while he was home on summer break from college. He had played a little 9-hole course with his brother and Paul. It was just after sunrise, and the grass was still damp with dew, and it had been chilly. Sunlight was starting to warm the distant green, burning off the morning fog, and the starter gave them the go-ahead to begin their round. Paul and his brother Rob had been golfing for years, and Scott wanted to take it up to spend more time with them. When they had informed him they would be arriving at the golf course at 5:30 in the morning, he almost decided to sleep in. He had carried a $2 golf bag, filled with an odd assortment of $1 golf clubs Rob had picked over from flea markets. The ball was one that had been reclaimed from the woods, but still appeared in good shape. The tee was brand new, bought in a pack of 20 from the golf course coffee shop for 50 cents. The round of golf cost $4. As he stood on the tee, he took a few practice swings, the club head never quite covering the same patch of grass twice, but he figured that was as good as it would get and stepped up to the ball. When he swung, the head of the club caught the edge of the ball, which popped it over 45 degrees to the right, disappearing in the woods. "Mulligan," Paul had offered as he tossed him another ball. Mulligans were free shots handed out in casual games to prevent an embarrassing start. Scott had topped the second shot, but it managed to go straight about 50 yards. Thus began an affliction that would get him out of bed at 5 a.m. most weekends that summer. His mind returned to the tee. He had no idea how long he had just drifted away. No one seemed to be hurrying him, and any tension he may have had was gone. "No mulligans today," he told himself. His body seemed to pull his club back almost involuntarily. His head remained frozen in position, staring at the yellow duck. As he reached the top of his backswing, he knew he had the shot nailed. He brought the club back around, and the ball went sailing, his eyes reflexively following its path. The ping of the club head echoed once from the trees. Scott held his driver dangling over his left shoulder, watching the ball, too afraid to take his eyes off it for fear it would drop and he would lose it. The golfers and caddies clapped impressed as they watched the ball land precisely in the middle of the fairway, bounce a few times, then roll to a stop. "Nice one," Paul said. Scott pulled his club off his shoulder, keeping his eyes on the ball. Paul took it from his hand. He turned and saw the red-haired camera woman staring in disbelief at the shot. Her camera was pointed slightly down, but he thought maybe she had taped the ball sailing out. "I'd say 310 yards, whispered Paul as he slid the club into its slot in Scott's bag. "Phew," muttered Jerry Spalding. His head was nodding from side to side. He slipped his tee into the ground near where Scott had shot. Without much fanfare, he set up his shot, waggled the club in his hands for a second or two, and almost too quickly to see, drew it back and slapped the ball down the right side of the fairway, almost as far as Scott's.
"First time I've been out driven in a while," he commented to Scott as he handed his club to his caddy.
"Lucky shot," was Scott's answer. Jerry looked back down the fairway and smiled.
"I'll take lucky over good any day."
Scott and Paul laughed at the old saying. They had exchanged the same sentiment with each other many times. Jerry patted Scott on the shoulder, and the three golfers and their caddies started walking down the dewy fairway. The loudspeaker from the clubhouse announced the next group starting. A few spectators wandered along behind them, sticking to the path cart. The camerawoman picked up a styrofoam cup of coffee from the ground next to her and sipped it as she followed the fans along. She looked back once to the clubhouse, but shrugged and walked on. Ellie had returned to the clubhouse earlier and was surprised to find Jason Bernard waiting for her with a cup of coffee. When she suggested she go out and get some footage of the early golfers, he agreed eagerly. She was sure he wanted her out of his hair, and it looked like she was going to do all the work today. She shrugged it off and went out to the first tee. Scott Hanover's drive was a thing of beauty. She decided she would follow his group, at least for a while. Paul pulled a club out of the bag and handed it to Scott. It was his 7-iron. Scott looked a little confused at Paul.
"I can make it to the green with my 3-wood, Paul," he whispered.
"You can make it to the sand trap, Scott. Get it up to 100 yards and then close to the pin for a 1-putt. You got 18 holes and a great chance to birdie this one."
Scott knew Paul was right. Risky wasn't smart, and he needed to play smart today. The short pine tree blocked Pete's shot to the green. He chipped it out at a 45-degree angle onto the fairway and ended a few yards behind Scott's ball, but slightly in front of Jerry. Jerry had what looked like a 3-iron out. He would likely try for the green and probably had the control to do it. Or was he taking a risk after being outdriven by Scott? With the same quickness as his tee shot, he powered the ball off the short fairway grass toward the green. After watching his ball for a moment, he snarled loudly, like an angry lion. The ball bounced, then rolled into the sand trap to the left of the green. Paul was grinning and nodding. That was likely where Scott was headed if he tried for the green in two. Scott was beginning to realize the value of his friend's advice. Pete also looked to be trying for the green, but favored a 3-wood. His shot took off straight for the pin. Unfortunately, he hit it better than he wanted to. The ball bounced on the back of the green and rolled down a slope out of view. Scott saw a hedge visible over the edge of the green and suspected it may have stopped the ball's continued progress. Pete's grunt signified a similar assessment of his shot. Scott walked over to his ball and took a few practice swings. He knew it looked pretty amateurish to Spalding and Baldwin, and he tried not to feel embarrassed. He slid his feet forward a few inches and placed the club head behind the ball. He didn't look at the ball this time, but instead at an imaginary ball, directly in front of and next to his actual ball. That would help ensure his swing would follow a trajectory that would bring the bottom of the blade of his golf club under the ball. His backswing pivoted perfectly around his spine, and as he brought the club around, his ball was lifted into the air, followed by a divot of dark green grass, which itself
sailed a good 15 yards. The ball landed, bounced once, and ended up about 100 yards from the pin. Perfect position for his pitching wedge. None of the players were on the green yet, but Scott felt he was in the best position. On a par 5, you're expected to take 3 swings to get on the green, and 2 putts to get it in the hole. If Scott could get his chip shot near the hole and sink the ball with 1 putt, he'd have a birdie to start out the tournament, and an incredible psychological lift. Paul said nothing as they walked toward Scott's ball. He'd never seen Scott hit 2 shots in a row so well. He noticed the ponytailed redhead walking along the cart path on the right side of the fairway. She was getting set to tape Scott's approach shot. The side of her camera had a USA Sports logo decal. He wondered if he and Scott might show up on the 9 o'clock sports wrap-up. He'd have to ask his daughter, Mary, to set up the VCR. She was the only one in the house who understood how to use the machine. Paul looked behind them. It seemed like there was more of a crowd around the tee than when they left a few minutes earlier. He pulled the pitching wedge from Scott's bag and handed it to him. "Be the ball," he encouraged, reviving the famous quote from Caddyshack. He watched as Scott lined up the shot, standing behind the ball and drawing his imaginary line. Scott set his feet and took a practice swing. Paul looked around. Everyone was still, waiting to see what Scott did. The camerawoman was poised and ready to tape Scott's swing. He looked back at Scott, who seemed to be in a trance. As his body began the swing, Scott seemed almost surprised by what was happening. He stopped short of a full backswing. Then the club came down perfectly, connecting with the back of the ball. A divot flew 10 feet ahead, but the ball was lofted into a high arc. Paul thought he could see the yellow duck spinning in the air. It was going to hit the green, no question. The pin was near the back, and the putting surface itself sloped toward the fairway. Scott's ball landed 2 yards to the left of the pin and bounced up about a foot, leaving a dark dent in the ground and landing another few inches closer to the hole. "How did you do that?" asked Paul. Scott stood staring at the green, his mouth hanging open. "I have no idea." "That's a doable putt, Scott." "Definitely doable. A gimme, almost," Scott added. "I don't think they'll give it to you," commented Paul. Gimmies were putts that were so close to the hole that it wasn't worth the effort to sink them. They were strictly forbidden in stroke play, especially in a tournament. "You're probably right. I guess I'll have to use the putter after all." "Don't want to let it feel left out, Scott," pointed out Paul. "Not at all," agreed Scott. The other golfers and caddies had wandered past them, nodding their appreciation of Scott's shot, all secretly wishing they were also on the green. The redhead came up to them. "You're Scott Hanover," she announced. "Yep." He looked at the logo on the side of her camera. "You're from USA Sports?" "Ellie Burke," she said, introducing herself and holding out her hand. Scott shook it. "Practicing your camera work for the top golfers later on?" Paul asked. "Yeah, I guess. But you never know when you'll catch something good." She patted her camera. Her shoulders and upper arms were muscular from hauling the equipment around. "You're having a great hole." "Best one today." They all laughed at the joke. "I wish I could put together 3 shots like that," she added. "Believe me, Ellie," Scott said, "this is not how I usually play." "Well, you're a lot better than I am. That's why I have this day job, you know." "If my wife wasn't convinced this was my last round of golf for the foreseeable future, I don't think she'd have let me out today. I should be home trying to figure out how to put that crib together in our nursery." Ellie looked confused. "Scott's not a real golfer either," explained Paul. "He's an architect with delusions of golf grandeur and about to become a father." "Congratulations," said Ellie. "Thanks," said Scott. Ellie looked down towards the green. Jerry Spaulding seemed to be muttering curses to himself in the sand trap, and Pete's caddy was carefully parting branches of the hedges behind the green in search of his player's ball. "Well, today you're showing these guys who the golfer is," she commented. "Wait till the next hole," offered Scott.
I just might. She smiled and walked back to the cart path to head for the green. Scott and Paul walked up the fairway and onto the putting surface. Scott replaced his ball with a tiny copper coin, smaller than a penny, then stepped back to allow the other golfers to play their next shots. Jerry's ball was half buried in the sand, the reason for his earlier curses. His shot was made tougher by the presence of the bunker on the other side of the green. He'd have to hit the ball just right to get it to stay on the green, let alone get near the pin. In his quick play style, he pounded at the sand with the club, and the ball popped out. It landed a foot away from the pin and kept rolling until it was on the fringe of the green, 3 inches from the other trap. He still wasn't technically on the green, but the ball was puttable, and he still had a decent shot at par, and maybe even a birdie if he made the putt. Pete's ball was trapped under the shrubs. He managed to pop it out somehow and made it onto the green, but the ball continued to roll, assisted by the downhill slope, ending up on the apron in front of the green, a good 20 yards from the hole. Pete wandered around the green, putter in hand, shaking his head from side to side. Still a remote chance for par, thought Scott. Pete was aiming for the hole, but only hoped to get it close. Too far, and he'd have a downhill putt for par. Too little, and he might still be 5 yards out. He hit the ball with deliberate force. It rolled up the unseen undulations of the green, veering to the right, ending up almost exactly opposite the hole to Scott's coin. Jerry took more time lining up his putt than he did with his other shots. The slowness of his putting stroke was in stark contrast to the speed of his other swings. He putted the ball off the narrow fringe surrounding the green. It passed right next to the edge of the cup and veered left, as if some force in the dark depths of the hole was trying to pull the ball in. He ended up only 12 inches away. With a casual, almost careless, single-handed swipe, he knocked the ball into the hole. He was in with a par. The red-jacketed tournament official indicated that Scott was furthest from the hole, so he readied himself for the putt. He walked off the green to the left, and Paul followed him. The ground sloped away, and he was able to view the short-cropped turf almost at tabletop height. The left-to-right slope of the ground was clearly evident. "Breaks pretty good to the right," said Paul. "Still doable," Scott said. "Oh, yeah." Scott walked up to his coin and carefully placed the ball in front of it, the duck facing to a point 6 inches to the left of the hole. If he wanted to get it in, he'd have to take the slope of the green into account and allow for some downward roll. The key was to hit the ball just hard enough so its trajectory would intersect with the hole, but not too hard that it would roll right through the break. He lined up the ball midway between his feet and placed the putter between him and the ball. He drew the club back a few inches and swung it in a practice arc, judging the speed he would need to hit it just right. 3 times he executed what he hoped was the perfect swing. Then he stepped forward to line up the center of the putter with the ball. With a slight twist of his head to the left, his eyes followed the trajectory he imagined the ball should take to land in the hole. Then his gaze came back to the ball. He did this 3 times as well, making very small adjustments to the angle of the putter, making sure it was aimed at the spot he had picked out to the left of the hole. With the same motion he used in his practice putts, he drew the club back, then pushed it into the ball. This is where years of playing miniature golf as a kid paid off. The ball bounced off the putter, the yellow duck rolling along the green. The ball's speed seemed to remain constant as it approached the hole, the slope of the green adding velocity, while the friction of the closely cropped grass slowed it down. As it approached within a foot of the hole, it turned slightly, angling directly toward the center of the cup, landing inside with a satisfying plunk. "Yes," Scott almost whispered. What a great way to start. He could bogey the next hole and still be shooting par. "Birdie," said Paul, drawing out each syllable with pride. Scott pulled out his ball and walked off the green past Pete Baldwin. Pete was shaking his head in disbelief. He lined up his putt, not taking nearly as much time as Jerry and Scott had. He hit the ball strong, straight for the hole, and right over it, ending up a yard and a half away. He looked like he wanted to pound the green with his putter. Resuming his stance, he retook the shot without the ball, trying to adjust in his mind the strength of his swing to let the ball drop satisfyingly into the hole. His sixth shot was almost too light. The ball rolled up to the lip and quavered for a moment before dropping in. Pete's caddy gave him a pat on the back and took his putter. Scott noticed a tournament official talking into a walkie-talkie and making some notes on a clipboard. It was probably an update to the clubhouse about how the three had finished up. He looked back toward the tee. The next group was already waiting halfway along the fairway to hit their balls on the green. The third group was waiting on the tee itself. Plenty more birdies coming today, he thought. His great hole would be lost in a sea of others, but what a great way to start the day. Jake Fisher was starting his second cup of coffee. He could feel the surge of caffeine still fighting through the lingering effects of the alcohol from the night before. His morning coffee had usually followed his first cigarette, and today he could taste the delicious flavor of the drink he usually consumed out of habit, a habit that was perhaps just as strong as his addictions to smoking and alcohol, but one he knew he'd allow himself to keep. Earlier, the official at the starter's table had eyed Jake with a questioning leer as he rummaged through the stack of credentials, wondering if Jake Fisher was really supposed to be there. Jake smiled and tried to smooth out his hair as best as possible. He pulled his jacket closed in the front to better obscure his dirty shirt and curled his left fore and middle fingers into his fist to hide the nicotine stains. He realized his appearance didn't present him in his best light. He hoped his offer of a contract would be taken seriously by Andrew Patterson, once he found him, that was. A badge was now clipped to his lapel, covering a stain on his jacket he hadn't noticed earlier. He took some time to study the pairings for the tournament, to get some idea of when Patterson would be teeing off. Between the tees for the first and tenth holes was a series of 4-foot by 8-foot plywood panels, each painted green with white lines drawn on them to create giant scorecards. Large green placards with the players' names carefully stenciled in white hung on small hooks on the left sides of the large scorecards. A separate board was reserved for the top 10 players at any given point in the tournament. Jake's knowledge of golf was limited to watching an occasional game on television and a few rounds he had played years before that had convinced him it wasn't a game tailored to his particular temperament. In addition, he could name a couple dozen professional golfers. His limited experience had instilled an admiration for those players who had the skill to consistently send the ball where they wanted over distances greater than 3 football fields. Like many sports, however, his ability to play or even understand the intricacies of the game was not necessary to successfully recruit an athlete. He found the best way to get in good with a player was to compliment them and let them talk. Athletes usually love to talk about their sport, and Jake would let them. Right now, he hoped his sports agent skills would do their trick on Andrew Patterson. The only description he had of his quarry was that he was quite a character. He noted on the information sheet he was given that Patterson was in the last threesome to tee off. The other two golfers were good, but not as impressive in their statistics as his target. Jake needed to be able to appeal to Patterson's ego, making sure Andrew knew that Jake knew he was the best golfer out there seemed a good place to start. He wanted Patterson to want Jake as his agent, as much as Jake wanted him as a client. Jake took his nearly empty coffee cup back into the clubhouse. Another refill was in order on this chilly morning, although the temperature had risen a little since he'd arrived. He noticed another man wearing an official credential pass on his lapel sitting at one of the formica and metal tables in the tiny dining area near the food counter. He was much more neatly dressed than anyone else, with a glaringly white pressed shirt and a red and gray patterned tie. His sports coat looked equally perfect and stylish. He was sipping a cup of coffee and holding a cell phone to his ear. With a shake of his head and a frustrated grimace, he punched the end button on the phone. Jake worked his way over to the table.
"Mind if I grab a seat?"
he asked. The man waved at an empty chair across from him. His badge identified him as Jason Bernard of USA Sports.
"Be my guest," Jason said.
"I wouldn't think this would be the type of event USA Sports would send a reporter to,"
observed Jake, nodding at Bernard's press pass.
"Me either," answered Jason.
He glanced at Jake's badge, squinting slightly to read the information.
"Foreman and Frakes, eh?"
"Yeah."
"You're an agent."
"Yep, Jake Fisher,"
he said, extending his hand. Jason shook it and suddenly realized something.
"Don't tell me. Andrew Patterson," he almost spat.
"He's my quarry."
Jason grabbed the thin plastic coffee stirrer and set a small whirlpool into motion in his cup.
"Some company wants an amateur golfer to sell goods?"
"Callaway," answered Jake. "They want a Cinderella."
"From what I've heard, they might be getting an ugly stepsister, Mr. Fisher."
"Please, call me Jake."
"I'm Jason," he answered, smiling for a moment. "Are you a golfer, Jake?"
"Nah, but I found I don't need to live a sport to sell it."
"If you can call this a sport," muttered Jason.
"I take it you're not hitting the links every Sunday?"
Jason laughed.
"How'd you end up here?" asked Jake.
"It's a long, unpleasant tale. I'm supposed to be out covering the marathon, but I seem to be a victim of demographics or some other sort of nonsense,"
explained Jason. Jake seemed confused, but sensed it was better to leave the explanation alone.
"I just got off the phone with a cameraman friend of mine, and some college kid is out challenging the Kenyans early, out of nowhere. There might be a surprise upset, not to mention a story out there today."
Jason sipped his coffee.
"So why does Callaway want a Cinderella?"
"There are hundreds of millions of dollars out there waiting to buy the newest ball to add 10 yards to your swing. If you want those dollars to buy your balls, you have to give them a good reason. If you get an amateur golfer who gets a shot to play a pro-am tournament, everyone is going to want to know what ball he recommends, because who knows? They could be next."
Jason laughed this time.
"Did you used to sell used cars in another life?"
"Nah, but it's nice to know you think I have an alternate career if this one falls through."
Jake was glad to see Jason smile. His idea of getting Patterson on the news would be much easier with Bernard on his side.
"Have you seen this Patterson fellow?"
he asked. "Yeah, you'll get a kick out of his outfit. Knickers and a funny cap. The whole 9 yards, if you don't mind me mixing my sports metaphors."
"Well, I guess it must be part of his charm," suggested Jake.
He wondered if such a quirk would hurt or help Patterson's ability to endorse a product. He concluded the more memorable a person was, the better.
"Well," began Jason, "the affiliate office in Chicago thought it might be nice to provide some local coverage for whoever ends up going to the Pro-Am. Sounds like Patterson is a lock. Once he tees off, we'll get some footage of him doing his golf thing, maybe a few quotes, get the heck out of here for a quick edit, and I'm home for a nice dinner with my wife."
"Nothing else worth covering out here?"
"Who said that was worth covering? I'll probably get bumped if something more interesting comes up, which, as things are, seems very likely."
"Well, I'll keep my eyes open for any newsworthy sports scoops for you," offered Jake.
Jason gave another chuckle. "Good luck."
His gaze suddenly fixed at a point over Jake's left shoulder.
"Speak of the devil," he said. "There's your boy now."
He nodded to a place outside the pro shop. Jake turned around and immediately found the scene that had caught Jason's attention. A tall, middle-aged, interestingly dressed man was having a very animated discussion with a medium-height, casually dressed, younger man. The discussion seemed to concern exactly where in the extremely large leather golf bag each of the golfers' clubs should be. The caddy seemed properly impressed with the placement of the clubs and the correct way to insert and remove them. Each one had its own custom head cover, and the putter was in a full-length sleeve. The older man's costume did exude a certain air, including a strong odor of pretentiousness, even through the glass of the pro shop window. A dark red leather pair of soft spiked golf shoes contrasted greatly with the green and purple argyle socks. Halfway up his calves, the green and yellow plaid knickers screamed all the way to his blazing white belt. From there, Argyle took over again in the sweater, combining a pattern of dark red and bright orange diamonds with yellow stripes splitting the diamonds into smaller shapes. His shirt was lime green and open at the collar. A coat of arms decorated the left breast of the sweater. In his left hand, the stem of a white-brimmed brown pipe, held by the bowl, helped to emphasize the golfer's gestures. The golfer wore spectacles rather than glasses, thin wire frames with large loops over the ears. He topped it off with a plaid Scottish tam, complete with a white and maroon pom-pom, plopped in the middle. Jake turned his head back slowly to look at Jason.
"How's that for charm?" Jason asked. "Meet Andrew Patterson, my friend."
It was Jake's turn to chuckle. What had Jonathan sent him into? He turned back to observe the scene again. Patterson gave his caddy a final admonishment and turned on his heel, his pipe now jutting from his mouth as he nodded in disbelief at the boy's apparent ignorance. Jake got up from the table to chase after the flamboyant golfer.
"If you see a redhead with a ponytail and a television camera, don't tell her where I am. I'll find her when I'm ready," Jason said.
Jake thanked the reporter for the information. The two men shook hands and Jake went outside. Unbelievably, his prey had vanished. He turned to the caddy to see if he might know where his boss had disappeared to. He might also be able to give Jake a better impression as to what Patterson was like. The more he knew, the better, and it seemed like there was a lot he needed to know. Sally Bernard followed the noise to the basement of the grade school building. Already, several dozen women were emptying boxes of donated items onto the tables and sorting through them. Most of the items had been set out over the previous week, but donations had been coming in every day, and there were always some last-minute pieces to sort and price. A few of the women greeted her as she came in, but they quickly resumed their work. The doors would be open to the public in less than an hour, and everyone felt the pressure to be ready. The Northfield Methodist Church Woman's Auxiliary Rummage Sale was a widely popular biannual event, and consequently the biggest fundraiser for the church. Many other groups had tried to copy it, but over the years the NMCWA had built up a loyal core of people who solicited and gathered items for the sale. No one else could match the selection and quality they garnered twice a year, and most had given up on trying to compete. Sally headed for her section of the basement. She called it the living room because she was in charge of things to be sold that people would likely put in their living rooms. There was a large area of furniture containing everything from sofas to rocking chairs, several with sold signs on them, as the women's auxiliary members had first choice of all the items, and many took the opportunity to single out the prime pieces for themselves. There was also a central area of coffee tables for sale, each decorated with knickknacks and tchotchke, every individual item also available to buy. Each one had a small rectangular sticker with an amount on it. As a rule, nothing at the sale sold for less than 25 cents, but usually the lowest she priced an item for was $1. From her years of experience, she knew how much an item had to be priced to get it to sell. Price it too high and you had to pack it up to be marked down in 6 months. Too low and you were in danger of risking not breaking the previous sales record. One of her little tricks to help get rid of little pieces was to group two or three with a larger item and sell them as a package. It seemed to work well, and others helping with the sale had started to copy her strategy. Sally found herself still fuming over Jason's unwillingness to discuss starting a family this morning. Every year, it was the same excuse. His career needed his full attention right now, but soon was always his answer. She loved him and knew he wanted a family. They had talked about it often before they were married, and she wondered if there was something else keeping Jason from pulling the trigger. She sometimes thought she might get pregnant on accident, but dismissed the idea, realizing that Jason might resent her for taking on such an important decision alone. Cecily Waterston was already there and had an office storage box filled with bric-a-brac and other last-minute items to be priced. Sally winced as she hoped against hope Cecily would not put her customary $5 price on everything. Cecily's philosophy was that people would be willing to pay those prices to help support the good work at Northfield Methodist Church. Sally knew where the money was going was less of a concern to the buyers than getting a great bargain on that crystal swan that was just like the one Aunt Edith had when I was a child. Cecily looked up from her work, a polite but small smile, careful not to ruin her perfectly applied makeup. Never mind that she was adjusting it every 15 minutes with her compact makeup kit anyway.
"Hello, dear," she said.
Dear was drawled out like a line spoken by Katharine Hepburn in an old movie. Sally had thought when she first met Cecily Waterston that her mannerisms had to be an act, but she quickly came to realize that was how she truly was, even down to the pointing pinky when she drank tea, not coffee, at the auxiliary meetings.
"Hello, Cece,"
greeted Sally, shortening the name to Cece, knowing that although it annoyed Miss Waterston to be addressed with such a nickname, she would say nothing.
"More things to price?" "I've got this batch, dear, but I think there's another box of coasters on the sofa over there."
"There" was drawled out nearly as severely as "dear." Sally knew that coasters offended Cecily almost as much as Cece did. Sally chuckled and headed over. She would check Cecily's pricing later as she rearranged the distribution of items on the tables.
"Hello, Sally," called a bright voice from nearby.
Ann Matterly approached her with her legal-sized clipboard, checking off a few items as she approached.
"Everything set over here with you girls?"
"Just the usual last-minute pricing," assured Sally.
"You know I am counting on you to sell at least $5,000 worth this year. We're definitely looking at another record if everyone does their part."
"We shouldn't have no problem with this selection," guaranteed Sally.
She looked over at Cecily, who was glancing over the items surrounding her with an ever-present expression of incredulity that people actually wanted this old stuff.
"Excellent, excellent," approved Anne. "You know everyone coming is looking to buy something," she reminded the ladies.
Sally smiled to herself as she heard Anne's slogan for perhaps the 20th time this week. Anne considered every unsold item a failure, even though it was rare that something would survive 2 rummage sales in a row. There was perhaps a 10% leftover after each Saturday free-for-all, but that was mainly due to the fact that there was no chance that anyone coming would get an opportunity to see everything. And oftentimes, second chance items, as Anne called them, were snatched up early in the next sale. Anne checked another box on her clipboard and headed to the next section, filled with kitchen items.
"What does she think we are, incompetent?"
asked Cecily, assuming Sally had the same impression of the matronly sales supervisor.
"I'm quite sure she doesn't, Cece. Ever since her husband died 5 years ago, this sale has been her reason to go on."
"Sad, I'm sure,"
commented Cecily. Sally held her tongue and turned back to her box of items.
"Oh,"
started Cecily a short time later, as if just remembering something important,
"I will have to leave early this afternoon. Can you handle the pack-up without me?"
"Early?" questioned Sally.
"Yes."
Cecily put down the last item she had just plastered with a $5 sticker and carefully adjusted her white cashmere cardigan sweater. The pearls around her neck accented its brightness. Her too perfect figure was slightly improved by the tightness across the mother-of-pearl buttons. Her distinctive red lipstick, pale, perfect complexion, and neat, dark hair gave a snow-white quality to her beauty. Although Cecily's attire seemed more appropriate for a Saturday afternoon tea, Sally not only didn't mind, but counted on her appearance to help sell some of her $5 items to men too distracted to notice they were getting ripped off until their wives yelled at them later.
"Andrew is playing in a tournament today, and we planned on going out to celebrate afterward. He has reservations at the Palmer House, and I need to get myself ready."
Sally glanced over to Cecily again. She seemed more than ready for a dinner at the posh steakhouse, but she shrugged her shoulders.
"Fine," she answered. "It shouldn't take too long."
In Cecily Waterston's eyes, Andrew Patterson was perfect.
If he said he was going to win, then by God, there was no question it would happen.
What is he playing in? Sally asked politely. It's some sort of golf thing. Only the best players in Chicago get to play, he's told me. He says he'll be able to play with professionals after this. It's ever so exciting for him, she explained with her own matching degree of excitement. Sally turned to face Cecily as she realized what she was saying. Andrew was playing in the golf tournament that Jason was going to cover today, the one that had him in such a bad mood. Really? Drawled Sally, half imitating Cecily's mannerisms. I do believe Jason will be covering it for his station today. Cecily was confused for a moment before recalling that Sally's husband worked for the local affiliate of a television sports network. Oh, how exciting for Jason. Perhaps he can get Andrew a tape. You know, a memento. Maybe, agreed Sally.
If only Andrew would lose today, and Jason caught it on tape. That would be something she wouldn't mind delivering to Cecily.
Thank you for listening to A Really Good Day, a novel by James Hosek, narrated by Rich Hosek. If you're interested in purchasing a hardcover edition of this story for yourself or a golfer in your life, visit jimbooks.myshopify.com. You'll get free shipping in the United States. You'll also get the complete audiobook and ebook editions with your purchase. And make sure to subscribe to the mailing list for updates about the upcoming release of his Doctor at Mystery series, cozy mysteries about a crime-solving veterinarian. Thanks again, and all the very best.